Alternative Radio.
Greetings and salutations to everybody out there in podcast land. This is the Judo Chop Suey Podcast, and I'm your host, Judo Dave Roman. Well, how about that? It's been a minute, hasn't it? I know it's going to be, by the time I release this episode, it's going to be about 2 months since I released my last episode. And of course, you know, the reasons are always the same. I'm not going to hash it out in the opening, but I tell you what, I will share some information, personal information on the after party, which is definitely going to happen in this episode because there's a lot that I want to cover on that. But on this episode of the Judo Chop Suey Podcast, I am going to bring on the head sensei of the Fresno Judo Club out in Clovis, California. That would be Dr. Larry Tsutsui. I bring out Larry on to talk about the American Judo Development Model and to talk about the United States Judo Federation, as he is on the promotion committee of the USJF. Now, I'm sure my foreign listeners out there are about to push that next button on their podcast player. Hold on a second. This is a very, very interesting stuff, because I think a lot of what Larry talks about and a lot of what the American Judo Development Model is trying to accomplish for the local instructor and for the national governing body, I think that applies to really every place around the country, because as I had with my last interview around the country, I meant around the world, or as we discussed in my last interview with Kiyoshi of Judo, judofan.com, judo population and popularity is going down across the world. And the situation with COVID around the world is not helping at all. Now, I want to be upfront and clear about this, is that the time of that recording, when I made that recording, was back in mid-November. So I may make date and time references in that interview that reflects a period of time when I had that interview, which is now coming up on 3 months ago, which, again, my apologies on the delay of the release of this episode. Now, before I get into the interview with Larry Tsutsui, I want to talk a couple of things related to judo, and first things first, I want to talk about the Olympics, and I got to say, put me in the camp that really doesn't believe the Olympics are going to happen despite what the IOC is saying and that they are committed to that date. I don't believe that's going to happen. I've been reading reports really over the past couple of months that it turns out, at least in the reports to Japan, And a large group of Japanese people, the majority of the population, really don't want the Olympics to happen in Tokyo. They are taking COVID very seriously, and they just see this, a lot of people see this as a national security risk in a lot of ways, and I can't blame them. So I reached out to Kiyoshi of judofan.com because I wanted to get his opinion on it. I've been hearing reports, like I said, sometimes I've seen a few on TV suggesting how the Japanese public feels about the event going on. And according to Kiyoshi, the state-run television channel in Japan, NHK, have been saying that the opposition to the Olympics is up to 80%. And in his opinion, it's probably higher in certain areas. So there's a lot of people not pleased and not excited that the games are going to be happening to begin with, because as it happens with, I take that back. I don't know about the United States, but in Japan, the entire country absorbs the cost of those Olympics. It's not just Tokyo. In the United States, I believe it's typically the local municipalities going all the way up to the state level that absorbs the majority of the costs for the Olympics. But Kiyoshi has implied to me that it's not just Tokyo bearing the brunt of that cost. It's everybody in the entire country. And when I asked Kiyoshi about this a couple of days ago, he said that the medical workers in Japan haven't even begun receiving their COVID vaccinations. And in his opinion, since the games are slated to start in July, he just doesn't see how the games can start, even though the officials are saying that it's going to happen no matter what. He doesn't think it's possible, and quite frankly, neither do I. And you know, here's another thing. Japan is damned if they do and damned if they don't if they hold these Olympics. Because if they hold the Olympics, well, they're not going to be receiving revenues like they would be with the masses of people that come into the country to watch, participate, you know, work, take part in the Olympics. You know, and just to give it as an example, last night, I'm recording this on February 8th. Last night, my Tampa Bay Buccaneers won the Super Bowl. I'm super excited about that, which is why my voice sounds a little bit hoarse right now. However, in the stadium, they had 22,000 people. That was nowhere near capacity, and they did that for social distancing reasons and such like that. And so what I'm trying to say is Florida has relatively lax or relaxed social distancing requirements for an event like the Super Bowl. But I know Japan takes this far more seriously, and I can't imagine that they would allow any of these places to be at a limited capacity. I just don't see it, not in terms of spectators, especially not with such a large amount of people against the Olympics happening. I feel like officials are going to have to compromise with the general public in this regard. So with no spectators, let's just say, they're not going to be making the millions upon millions of dollars that they need, which means it's going to affect funding for all athletes across all sports. So if they have the games, it's going to affect funding. If they don't have the games, then really all the sports federations are going to be impacted with no Olympic money being delegated to them. And of course, that ultimately hurts judo. And here's the thing that just dawned on me, and I'm probably stating the obvious for anybody that competes at a high level, is that this pandemic has essentially impacted the 2024 games as well. Because we've already crept into the next Olympic cycle, and these athletes just simply haven't been competing. Though I gotta say that I suppose everybody on the world tour is going through the same exact thing, but even if they're preparing on their own, you know, in secret gyms and things like that, it's still not the same as regularly competing and regularly training at your Olympic training center. And, you know, now with a vaccine rolling out, and which is great and everything, but as soon as the vaccine starts rolling out, here we go again with new strains of coronavirus and things like that. And I don't know if it's going to end. I don't think it's going to end. I think we're always going to have coronavirus. So I think it's just a matter of accepting it, accepting the risks, and moving on. That being said, I have not been regularly training over the past couple of months simply because I thought that the numbers were coming down, but it really hasn't, and that's just not a risk that I'm willing to take at this time, as much as that sucks. And it's been a real downer for me, especially the past 2 or 3 months. It's been tough in some ways. It's just really disappointing. Now, what wasn't disappointing was seeing the Doha Masters and seeing IJF judo action back on YouTube or Ippon TV or whatever it is that you catch judo online. It was really nice to see the Doha Masters. Of course, I did not see every match because of the time zone differences and such. And I'm not going to cover all of the matches that I saw. I'm really not even going to go into too much detail on who the winners are and who the losers are. At this point, you know, a month after the event, you know, you all can find that online. So I wanted to touch on a couple of things, though. First and foremost, Teddy Riner is back. And not that he's back just on the mats. I mean, he's back. I mean, he looked amazing to me. And the thing is that I saw about a week before the Doha Masters, I looked on his Instagram. I didn't even recognize who he was. He's gotten so lean. He looks like an NBA player. You know, I think I remember I joked. I can't remember if I joked on the podcast or with somebody else that back when he came back from his break in 2018 into to the Montreal Grand Prix, I joked that Teddy Riner looked like he ate Teddy Riner. And at that time, if I were to guess, even at 6'8", he was about 350 pounds at least. I mean, he did not look like the typical athletic specimen that I'm used to seeing Teddy Riner being. However, he's really become serious with his nutrition and his training, and I gotta think he looked to be a slightly under 300 pounds, which for him and his size, that would make him look very lean. And even though in some of his contests he wasn't as sharp as we're used to seeing him in years past, he certainly looked better than he did when he came back for the Montreal Grand Prix, and certainly in last year's Paris Grand Slam. I mean, he just looked night and day. He looked like somebody that was not going to lose another match for the next 4 years. I mean, that's how good he looked. Now, he ended up defeating Inal Tasoev via Shido. Tasoev ended up getting three Shidos in the final match. So Teddy wins gold on that day. Yeah, I know it's over a month ago, but still. And some of the other performances that stood out to me, just going by memory here, Noel Vantaend ended up winning his division in the under 90 kilos. Daria Bilo did not win her division, but it's worth noting that she did move back down in weight. She was competing in the under 48 kilo division. If I recall correctly, it was Krasniki of Kosovo that ended up winning the under 48 kilos. Clarice Agbegnenu ended up winning gold. That does not surprise me at all. I think Yoko Ono won her division. Actually, if I recall correctly, there was on the women's side, there seemed to be a lot of winners and top seven places for the Japanese team, at least on the women's side. I don't recall seeing Hifumi Abe or Shoei Ono competing in this Doha Masters. Now, there's two other things from a local level, at least from a national level in the United States, that I wanted to bring up. A few days ago, I received a message from a friend of mine, Justin Smith, who runs Platte River Judo out of Casper, Wyoming. Now, I met Justin out at JudoCon back in 2019, and he wanted to let all the listeners know, and myself included, that his dojo is hosting the very first P3 training course ever out in his area. Now, P3 stands for, let's see here, the Police Professional Plan, which is a training course created by law enforcement officers for law enforcement officers. And it's my understanding from Justin that my good friend Tabrin Lee, who I had on as a guest several months back, is heading this thing. And I guess the general idea is that it's a way in a training course to teach police effective techniques to gain control of a person, but not necessarily doing this through specific judo techniques. So it's not like in this course that they're going to teach, you know, fellow law enforcement officers how to do uchimata, you know, to ude gurame or something like that. That's not going to happen. And if I were to venture to guess, this is more about teaching people how to use, you know, certain situations and certain movements to help aid police officers get some people that they are confronting under some semblance of control, which I think is very important because, you know, when I see these terrible videos out there of law enforcement or officers just losing control of a situation, I think if they had a good understanding of basic principles in judo, that it could go a long way of trying to de-escalate a situation without necessarily resorting to violence. And I think as judoka, we can certainly draw the line between what we do in training and even what we do in competition versus violence. So if any of you out there are interested in making that trip to Wyoming, which is a beautiful state for at least what I'm told and what I've seen in pictures, the P3 is going to be held on between March 8th through 11th, between 8:30 a.m. and 3:30 p.m. every day with 30 minutes for lunch. It's going to be held at the Wyoming Law Enforcement Academy, which is at 1556 North Riverbend Drive in Douglas, Wyoming. So yeah, there you go. Now, there is one more thing that I wanted to bring everybody's attention to, and I think this is a really good thing. Gary Goltz has been writing articles as of late in Black Belt magazine covering judo and different topics about judo. Now, yes, it does have an American point of view on things that are specific to judo in the United States. However, Gary, he's a very thoughtful writer, and he knows how to get his points across very clearly. So the name of the blog on Black Belt Magazine, it's called it's called Basically Just Judo. I wonder where we've heard that one before. Well, I know that unlike other people, Gary is definitely not putting down Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu in any way at all. That much is certain. Now, I've been reading Gary's articles from what he shares on his Facebook to various judo groups. However, I don't know if these articles can be seen just from the Black Belt Magazine website. Does Black Belt Magazine even exist, like, in, you know, you can actually buy the magazine? I don't know. I know it sounds like a stupid question, but, you know, back when I was a kid and I'd see, you know, we would go to the grocery stores when there was no internet and everything. You would just go to the grocery stores. If you wanted to see anything on martial arts, you would just pick up Black Belt Magazine and in the books and magazine section of my local, whatever, Stop and Shop or whatever it was back then, A&P. That was a New York City thing. Anyway, well, except when I was a kid, I would get Trans World Skateboarding and Thrasher Magazine. Those were my reads back in the day because that's what I did. But I would thumb through the Black Belt Magazine every once in a while because I always loved seeing pictures of ninjas and ninja stars and nunchaku and bow staffs. I just like seeing people in ninja outfits and throwing stars. That was awesome to me. So I would never actually buy the magazine because money was hard to come by back in 1985, but at least I would thumb through it and then put it back in the wrong place. So yeah, so Gary's writing for Black Belt Magazine. I think that's a really good thing. It gives more exposure to judo, and Lord knows we all need it, right? So anyways, I am going to bring on Dr. Larry Tsutsui. And as I mentioned before, Larry is the head sensei of the Fresno Judo Club. He is also on the promotion committee of the United States Judo Federation. And he's also a part of the coaching committee on the American Judo Development Model. So I brought Larry on. He had reached out to me, well, now this is going back in early November, expressing interest to come on the program to talk a little bit about this. So I'm like, sure. And by the way, if anybody out there is listening to this, and if you got something that you want to pump out and share with the judo community, it doesn't matter what country you're from, just let me know. I'll do it. That's what I'm here for. So anyway, without any further delay, here's Dr. Larry Tsutsui. Larry, welcome to the Judo Chop Suey Show. How are you doing today?
Doing great.
So you had reached out to me probably about two or three weeks ago. You wanted to come on the show, and I thought you would be an interesting guest to bring on to discuss some of the things about the American Judo Development Model and what the future plans for that are that go beyond maybe the documentation that was released. But before we get into that, can you give the audience an introduction on who you are and, you know, where you teach or train and a little bit about yourself, a little bio information.
Sure. I'm Larry Tsutsui. I'm the head instructor of the Fresno Judo Club. Fresno is located in Central California. Fresno Judo Club's been around since the 1950s, and I've been going to Fresno Judo since the 1970s. I actually started at the Fowler Judo Club in 1970, and I went to Japan with Mr. Yamamura in 75, and he had told my father that I needed to practice more than two times a week, that he should bring me to Fresno Judo. So at that point, I was practicing at two judo clubs, the Fowler Judo Club and the Fresno Judo Club. And then in the 2000s, at some point, Missy Momura asked me to take over as the head instructor of Fresno Judo. But he was always there, and so I always felt like, okay, he's the head instructor, I'm just the assistant.
Sure.
So you know how that works.
of course, definitely.
So today, yeah, Fresno Judo, we've grown quite a bit. On paper, we have 150 members, but active before COVID, we had 120 members. And right now we're practicing. We started Zoom classes. And when we were able, we were practicing in the parking lot. And then we went indoors when we could, but we, you know, had everybody six feet apart. And then in California, we're back in the purple. So we're back in outdoor judo and we're continuing the Zoom classes. So we're pretty lucky and we still have good support from our members. It's, you know, as everyone knows, judo is different today, but we're plugging along here.
So what is your Zoom class curriculum like? Because I've seen quite a number of people try and run classes through Zoom. So, and everybody does something a little bit different. What is your objectives with your students through these Zoom classes?
So we just want them moving and, you know, we're doing a lot of just physical exercises and then a lot of shadow chikomi. We're adding the pulling bands. And so in the beginning, we had two classes twice a week and we had between 30 and 40 students coming.
Nice.
And then when we opened up the dojo, some of those students, you know, came to the parking lot and then our Zoom classes went down to about 30. But I think we're back up to between 30 and 40. And then in our parking lot last night, I think we had about 15 kids in the first class and about 20 people in the second class working out in the parking lot. And it's sort of the same thing. We're doing a lot of exercises spaced out apart, a lot of shadow chikomi. And then again, we have pulling bands that we're using. We have one instructor who's a physical therapist and we asked him if he could, you know, get some TheraBands for us. And
yeah, those are great.
He was very kind and he donated and, you know, we gave all those out and then we ended up needing more. And we're actually on our third round of ordering those bands because it's working so well.
That's fantastic to hear. Now, when was the last time anybody in your club did physical contact judo? And I ask this because, we live in a very large country. We have very different dynamics on how each state is dealing with COVID. It's my impression that California is among one of the strictest states in the nation. So have anybody been able to do contact judo at all in the past 9 months, really since March?
No, that's Wow. Pretty much when we had to close March of this year. So I know, you know, in our area in Central California, we're the only club that's doing something. The other clubs are pretty much closed right now.
Your role, I want to talk a little bit about the American Judo Development. Before we get into that, were you going to add something to there? I apologize if I cut you off.
No, you're fine.
Okay, just making sure. Actually, before I get into the American Judo Development Model topics, can you tell me a little bit about your history with judo in the United States? And I ask this because even long before I've done this podcast, I've actually heard of you all the way out in the East Coast of Florida over here. So I've always had the impression that you've been, you know, a member of the judo community with some high regard. Do you serve in any capacity in the national governing bodies apart from the what you're doing with the American Judo Development Model?
Yeah, my position with the United States Judo Federation is I'm the chair of the Coach Development Committee. And then there's also, it's called the Five Star Dojo Program. And I'm the chair of that, but I'm turning that over to my daughter because she does all the work and I get the credit, but I just decided, well, you might as well be the chairman because I'm not doing anything.
That's funny.
But my main job is coach certification. And so with USGF, our coach certification, it's an online program. And so it's still active and we're still certifying coaches. And so with COVID, what I started doing, you know, people were, as this has been going on and on, towards the end of the summer, I just decided instead of a 2-year certification, I made it to the end of 2022 because there's no activities for coaches. And so even now, I think if someone's going to certify with USGF, I'm going to tack on an extra 3 months because we're not able to use the certification. We're not coaching on the mat, but people are still getting online and certifying. So it's really good.
Now, when you say that people are getting online and certifying, are they getting online and taking a quiz of sorts or taking an online course? And then at the end that there's some kind of a quiz?
Yeah. So they register online and then we have our manual was written by Hayward Nishioka. You know, he's a ninth dan from Nanka and it's the coaching manual. And so basically after you register, pay your fee, the national office mails you the manual and then you can do the online examination that has questions, you know, based on the chapters in the manual.
And if somebody were to pass the course, I'm just trying to understand this because I'm not part of the USJF. If somebody passes the course, is there an in-person portion? That seems the impression that I got.
So we used to have an in-person portion. And so USJF also has what we had was master coaches. And, you know, the master coaches were able to put on seminars locally for their local judo clubs, but we're sort of, you know, it's a changing world where especially the younger people, they want to do things online. And luckily for us, Hayward Nishioka and Mitch Palacio had the foresight to create this online portion of it. So in the transition, there was live and there was the online, but now we're just transitioning to online. And, you know, again, it's the manual and then you do the questions online and I get a notification that somebody answered the questions and I have to go online and check their scores and let them know if they passed or didn't pass. And then once they pass, we'll issue a certificate and badge, coach badge for them.
Now, what does the certificate and coach badge entitle to you? I would venture to guess that that means that you would be allowed to represent your athlete on the side of the mat as a coach. I would venture to guess that's it. Is that the case? Is there other things that signifies being certified as a coach by the USJF?
Yeah. So the coach certification, that's what it's for, is allowing you to coach mat side. So from the local level to the national level. And with the American Judo Alliance agreement, part of that was reciprocity among the organizations, allowing coaches from each organization to coach at each other's events. And that was a big deal with USA Judo, because before, to coach at a USA Judo, like the Junior Olympics, their tournament, you had to be a USA Judo certified coach. Well, with the American Judo Alliance, you can be a USJA or USJF certified coach and coach at their events now. So the thing that it limits us is that you can't coach internationally. So like they had the tournament in Guadalajara, you're required to be a USA Judo coach for an international tournament because that's under the Pan American Confederation and IJF.
That's right. Right. Okay. That makes sense. I thought that might have been the case. I did forget about the reciprocity with the American Judo Alliance. Judo Alliance, is that correct? Do I got that right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah, I do remember covering that many years ago, probably back in 2018. Right. So and out of that came the American Judo Development Model. Now, it seems like it's taken a long time to get put together and stuff. I know it must be very difficult to get so many people from different areas in different parts of the countries with, you know, different roles and responsibilities. Can you talk a little bit about that process and what that might have looked like from your position, just how things kind of came into place?
Sure. So, you know, the original athlete development models, the United States Olympic and Paralympic Committee wants all national governing bodies to have an athlete development model. And the reason for that is in sports, kids, the participation in sports is dropping in all sports except for three. And so The athlete development model was big in Canada, and it's spreading around the world. I understand even in Germany, they're using an athlete development model. But the USOPC wants all sports in the US to have this model because they're saying, where are our athletes going to come from for the future? We need to do something to help all sports. And so judo, with the American Judo Alliance, that sort of opened up having all three organizations working together for this program. And I think one of the biggest things people don't understand is there's the AJDM document, which there was a AJDM committee. They started working on that in 2018. And when they completed the document, then my committee was activated, and my committee is the coach task force. And so the coach task force were the next part of the AJDM program. And so there's actually four parts to this. There's the American Judo Development Model document. There's the Foundations of Coaching, which is the online program for $30. And that program, it's a coaching program. When we saw it in Colorado Springs, it was actually designed for USA Sailing. And so part of what the coach task force did was we had to modify that for judo. So that was one thing, was making some changes to the pictures and some of the wording and the resources to make it more judo specific. But the overall program is, it is a coaching program for anyone. You know, it's just good coaching principles for any sport, but we were able to modify it. And so that took us a while. We had a deadline of December 31st last year to get that done because of funding. So that was one part of it. And the next part of our group is the live seminar. And the live seminar is, how do we teach judo so that people will want to stay in judo and stay in judo for life? So the biggest goal is retention, growing judo. How are we going to grow judo in the United States? And the example I always talk about is when we had our meetings, the representative from USA Boxing, he told us the story of, you know, how an 8-year-old goes to boxing on the third session. He gets punched in the nose. He has a bloody nose. He's crying, and he quits boxing. And he says, well, that's boxing, you know, and the kid, it's just, well, that boxing wasn't for that kid. And I think a lot of times judo instructors, we do that too, is, you know,
I agree,
we're throwing someone too hard too soon and they quit. And we don't think it was our fault. We think, well, that child judo wasn't for that child. You know, and really, we have to look at it from a different perspective of, well, wait a minute, maybe it's us, not them. And how are we going to change things to make judo grow? You know, because the reality is judo hasn't been growing. You know, I know, especially in the USGF, we've been stagnant at 10,000 members for years and years and years.
Sure.
And every judo club gets new members, but you know, in a year or two, your numbers haven't grown. We're losing them just as fast as we gain them. So there's, you know, and this is happening not just in judo, but in a lot of sports. Like I said, all sports but three are losing participants. And so that's why the USOPC is saying, well, you got to have this athlete development model to change things. And so another example was USA Archery. The representative from them said, you know, these archery coaches want their athletes to shoot 500 arrows a day, every day. And they're ending up with repetitive stress injuries. And,
yeah, right.
You know, you need to have them doing other things that will keep them in shape. And so, what we're looking at on the live seminar is, okay, let's have a system to teach judo that's going to teach it in a way that we're not going to lose, you know, not only from children, but through adults. And so that's the live seminar. And the fourth part of the American Judo development model is we're calling it resources. And if you go to the website, we're trying to build a library of different things where anyone can go to, parents, coaches, judo players, and see resources to be a better judo player, to be a better coach, you know, to understand judo better. and so we're actually asking people, you know, to contribute, because we can't, our little committee, you know, there's so much out there.
Sure, of
and
course,
there's a
right.
lot of good stuff out there. And so if you go to the website there, I think there's a notice there asking, hey, if you have anything you want to share, or if you have any questions, you know, let us know. You know, we're this is just the beginning. And, you know, all three organizations, we want to improve judo. We want judo to grow, but it's going to take everybody.
You know, you brought up an example, and it's one that I've kind of seen for myself in judo clubs. You brought up the example about the boxing coach, and I've seen that kind of approach in judo myself. In fact, I would say my first club was very much like that. But when I started judo, there was no way you were going to get me off the mat. I knew it was something that I loved that I knew I would love doing, and I absolutely was right about that. However, I was kind of the exception to it. Didn't matter what happened to me on the mats. I was coming back the next day. How do you think it's possible to change that kind of a coach or an environment that has that kind of mindset towards judo? Because for me, I think because I was the exception in taking that kind of just repeated punishment, I think there's a lot of people that gets turned off by that. Do you think it's possible to change that within the judo community in this country, just as a general whole? You think you could reach out and influence people in that way?
You know, the another name for this athlete development model is long-term athlete development model. And because, you know, we know that people aren't going to just automatically go, hey, this is great, let's change, because yeah. change is very difficult. You know, change makes people uncomfortable. And, you know, I think especially in judo, it's, well, this is the way I learned it, so it's the way I teach it, you know. I think today one of the things that's different is the internet, YouTube. You know, people, so many people are looking at YouTube and are trying to learn judo, learn new techniques. And, you know, that's sort of scary, especially when you get a beginner who wants to do uchimata.
Yeah.
You know, that's a disaster waiting to happen. And I think, you know, we have to change the mindset of these instructors, but it's going to take time. And you know, it really has to do with instructors, people who want to do, you have to want to change. You have to want to improve your program. You know, if you're looking at it as, well, I know everything, so I don't need any help, you know, we're in trouble.
So is Fresno Judo Club a full-time club? So you're a chiropractor, but does anybody run that club as, you know, as an everyday thing? Are there classes in the mornings and the afternoons?
Everything's in the evening except for Sunday is a morning practice.
Okay.
And so on Monday, Wednesdays, the Imamura brothers run that practice, and it's part of the Fresno State team, and our advanced kids go with them on Monday, Wednesdays. Tuesday, Thursdays, the kids class, our younger instructors run it. A couple of my daughters are there and some other instructors. I show up and just stand there and you know, just stand on the edge of the mat and watch them. And then the advanced class, actually we have a adult beginner class and I run that. And then our advanced class, either I'll let the younger instructors run it or I'll run it or, and then on Fridays we have what's called open mat. And so the Umar brothers and I, whoever shows up, we're all there to run that program. And so our Friday night practices, we have open to anybody. Anybody can come visit us and train. And then Sunday mornings, so Miss Steve Murray used to run the Sunday morning practice. And just to tell you a little story of why he did that, he used to tell us the reason he practices Sunday mornings is because San Jose State doesn't. And his goal was always to beat San Jose State.
Oh, okay.
So that was that's where our Sunday morning practices came from. But now one of our younger instructors, he runs that practice. And so, you know, that's one of the things for all judo clubs. Sorry about that.
Don't worry about it.
So one of the things all judo clubs, I think, really need to do is groom the young people to teach and instruct. You know, it's, if I were to walk away from Fresno Judo, we would be fine. We have, you know, we've taught our instructors. They've, you know, it was sort of the way when Misty Memorial was running the club, I would say, Sensei, can we do this? And he would always tell me yes. And he'd, Sensei, can we do this? And then, you know, just over time, he gradually let me do more and more things. And so I'm doing the same thing with my young instructors, and either I'm telling them, hey, go do this, or I'll say, what do you want to do? And, you know, and I'll observe. And when I was teaching with Misty Murmura, he used to sit on the edge of the mat in a chair. And if I was teaching something and he stood up, I was like, uh-oh, I did something wrong. And he'd come and say his, correct me, basically. And so it's the same way, you know, I sort of stand back, let the young instructors do it, and then sometimes I'll tweak what they're doing. But you know, they're really good, and that's what we have to do. So, but Fresno Judo, we're all volunteers. We're doing it because we love the sport, and you know, Mr. Yamamura was our role model. He was like a second father to me, and you know, he, like I said, he had judo practices 6 days a week.
Since we are on the topic of coaching here, do you feel there's enough coaches in judo in the United States as a whole? I don't think that I should ask, do you think there is enough coaches in the United States right now to support this development model?
I think we all know there's certain areas of the United States that there are a lot of judo people, and there's certain areas of the United States that there aren't very many judo people. And so, you know, in the big picture, no, there aren't enough coaches. We need more judo coaches, and you know, and we need more judo clubs to let go of their younger instructors and let them go off and start their own programs.
That's funny you say that. You know, I don't, for those listening, it's November 25th, I just released my latest episode, episode 84, and I actually brought that up a bit. I'm not sure if you're aware, but the United States Judo Association recently changed their guidelines for promotion, and they're now, people don't no longer have to travel long distances to see a certified rank examiner, and I think that's a good thing overall. But I had openly questioned myself, you know, could that system potentially create a situation where younger students feel a sense of loyalty to the senseis that promoted them? And I just thought it was interesting that you brought up that, because I agree that I think some senseis need to allow their younger students to open up their own club, and not allow in the sense of permission, but maybe give their blessing of sorts.
You know, it's hard for some of these older senseis to let go. And I could probably say, you know, maybe 20 years ago, I might've been that way a little bit too, is, you know, what are you doing? You don't know anything, mm-hmm. You know, but like I said, I've been changing, and you know, I want our club to grow, and I can't do it by myself. I have to have, you know, if it weren't for my young instructors, and I don't know if you know, but I have eight kids, and out of the eight, four are black belts, and three are still active. And
nice.
You know, it was with their help that Fresno Judo really took off. I mean, they're the ones running our Zoom class, and they're the ones running our parking lot practices with some other younger instructors. And I come and I stand there. Sometimes I make comments, but you know, right now, they're really running the show for us, and especially on Zoom. You know, it's a different tool. My one daughter, she was a school teacher, and she was using Zoom to teach her fourth grade class, and so it was easy for her to transition to doing it for judo. And I don't know if you've seen, she's done three sessions for USJF to teach other instructors around the country, you know, how to do Zoom and give them some ideas. And she did that with a man from Sawtell Judo down south, and they've been doing Zoom classes. And so they put on three sessions to share their ideas and help people, you know, because it's a different world. And if we want judo to keep going today, we got to do what we got to do.
Of course, I hear you there. So I want to start diving in a little bit with some of my questions with regards to the American Judo Development Model. How did you get involved with this project? Was this just because you were already involved in your role as the, I apologize, the coaching chair, the,
Yes. So I'm the coach development chair.
Coaching development chair. Okay.
2 years ago at the San Jose Buddhist Tournament, the USGF president, Mark Muranaka, was there, and he saw me and he said, "I need to talk to you." And it started from there.
Just the conversation.
He told me what it was about and asked me if I would participate as a representative for USGF. And so that's where it started.
So can you tell me, this is when I've read the documents and stuff, I thought the presentation was really well put together, but what I don't really get a sense of is the high level objective of this development model. Is it to produce an Olympian for 2028, or is it more about growth as a whole?
So I don't think we've ever said it's to produce an Olympian, but we look at it as there's two pathways in this development model. And one pathway is competition and high level competition. So if you look at the document, you know, as you move up in skill or age, you're practicing, you know, 5-10 times a week, and you're supplementing with other trainings. And so that pathway is for the elite athlete. And the other pathway, you know, we're calling judo for life. It's people who want to do judo because they love judo, not necessarily because they want to be a world champion or Olympic champion. And so the model is for both. But we've never said, oh yeah, this is going to produce an Olympic champion. We've just said that there's two pathways in this model. And one is the elite athlete, and the other is the, you know, you want to do other things in judo. You want to be a referee. You want to be a coach. You know, you want to be a judo club sensei. So it's supposed to be covering both sides of that.
Okay, understood. I wasn't sure, and the reason why I asked is because I wasn't sure if the committees involved had a specific goal with 2028 in mind with the games in Los Angeles. That would be kind of neat though, I would think. But so with the competition path that you were just discussing, and I did read the outline of that. I'm curious to know, will there be a start to finish guide for coaches? I don't mean right now. I mean, eventually, that will help coaches, you know, teach them how to run a class for a high performance athlete that is supposed to be training twice a day. Cause you know, for myself, as you brought up earlier, most of us teach judo the way that we were taught. I would not know the first thing about even attempting to coach a kid beyond a, you know, local or regional level. Will there ever be a time when that that kind of guidance is provided by the American Judo Development Model, or is that kind of thing just still left up to the individual coaches to come up with their own program?
I think in the long term, we want to have, you know, the next level of a coaching teaching program. We haven't, you know, we're still working on what we have now. You know, we haven't launched the live seminar because of COVID.
Of course.
It's ready to go, but part of that is we call it train the trainers. You know, so we're still focusing on basically stage one. But I believe, you know, if we want this to grow and we want judo to grow, we're going to have to do that. We're going to have to, you know, what are ideas for conditioning and what are ideas for improving technique of an elite athlete? I think we're definitely going to have to do that. And, you know, in our committees, both committees, we have former Olympians and national champions that are part of this. So, you know, we do have that level of athlete consulting in the committee. So.
Now, this is a great segue, by the way. Now that you're talking about the committees, can you give me a little bit of more information at a high level? What is the foundational task force committee and what is the coach task force committee? And I know you belong to the coach task force committee, but I really don't understand what those committees are or what their objectives are.
So the Foundational Task Force Committee was originally called the American Judo Development Model Task Force, and okay. Because they're the ones who worked on the document. And so they completed the document, and now what they're working on is starting a business and marketing committee program. And so they've been doing surveys and more specific surveys with successful dojos, and they're trying to, and then I think now they're in the process of finding people to be on this new task force. Because part of, you know, starting new dojos is how do you do that?
Of course.
You can't just run out there and, you know, rent a space and, you know. USDF actually has a program for that, but I don't think anybody knows. Maybe a small handful of people know that USDF has a program to help you start a new dojo, and it's Hayward Nishioka's mini dojo program. It's an excellent program. You actually learn how to create a resume and the documents you need to go to a YMCA or to go to a Brazilian jiu-jitsu school and make a proposal of, hey, let's start a judo class. That exists, but, you know, we're trying to have something, my understanding is they want to have a marketing and business committee, you know, for all judo, which is a good idea because
I agree.
You know, that's one of the things as a head instructor of Fresno Judo, I keep saying, you know, I wanted to grow our club, but we have bills to pay.
Yeah. So,
and, you know, I think a lot of people, that's what holds you back is, you joined a judo club. It was already there. You have no idea how to start a judo club. You know, no sensei say, okay, this is how you start a judo club. But,
and I did not know. I did not know that the USJF even has got, you know, documentation and guidelines to do such a thing. I think that's good for the listeners to know, at least the American listeners.
it is a really good program. He put a lot of work into it, and it walks you through everything of being professional and you know, how to start it up. And the other thing, I don't know if people know, is USGF has grant money, and I don't think people apply for it. You know, if you apply for a grant, maybe to buy mats or something, maybe you can get a grant and help start your dojo. I don't know if USA Judo has that or USGA, but I know USGF, you know, that's one of the functions of USGF is supporting clubs, but you can apply, and I believe, you know, that there's funds for that.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
With regards to the USJF, the USJA, and USA Judo, I know all of these committees are made up by members that span all three of these judo organizations. Do the organizations themselves focus on specific things, or is it? I don't know if I'm asking that question correctly. I'm curious if the USJA, or I should say in your case, does the USJF as an organization have certain areas that they are focusing on with this development model, or is it just really cross-collaboration?
It's cross-collaboration. I mean, in my committee, I don't know about the other committee, but in my committee, we have, we call it pre-work, which included the foundations of coaching. We have the live seminar, and we have the resources. And so those, we had our meeting in Colorado Springs in August of 2019, and Chris Snyder, who was the USOPC coach development chair, he was the one who ran this meeting. And at the end of the meeting, he divvied up, he told us, okay, this is what we need. And so, on the pre-work, Chima from USJA is heading that up. On the live seminar, I'm heading that up. And on the resources, Ari Miller from USA Judo is heading that up. So we, in our committee, the lead people under those three areas, it's one from each organization, but we're all working together.
Now, the coach task force committee that you're a part of, can you tell me what that is about and what the objectives of that committee is?
So the original objective, I believe, was to try to have a uniform teaching program of judo across the United States. And the way it was told to me was, you know, if you start judo in California and you move to New Jersey, that the instruction the foundational instruction would be similar through this program. And so originally we were saying, okay, this will be a coach certification program accepted by all three organizations. And the original idea was that after we develop this, each organization would take it and administer it in the way they wanted to. You know, we would all charge the same fee, but this whole thing is evolving as we go along. And so it's changed from giving it to each organization to do what they want to, no, we're going to continue working together. And rather than make it a coach certification program, because, you know, we're not focusing on coaching on the side of the mat. We're focusing on how do you be a coach in a dojo, and how do you be an instructor in the dojo, I think, more than in a competition situation. So we agreed to not make it a coach certification, but make it more of a, you know, a teacher in the dojo program, And then, and again, it's going to grow from there. This keeps evolving. And so the original intent has evolved over time.
So the original intent was to standardize how like judo techniques are taught. That was the original intent?
Yeah, more, I think more so in the beginning, we wanted how to teach beginners.
Okay.
In a standardized way.
Is it safe to say that that's not the direction that the task force will be going, or am I wrong about that?
Yeah, to be honest, I'm not sure where we're going to go. I'm not sure, you know, is the next step going to be the same people, or is it going to change people? You know, because one of the things is USJA has a new president. USJF, we're having elections next month. You know, the leadership could change, and you know, I may not be the coach chair with the leadership change. If the leadership changes or doesn't change, you know, it's at the discretion of the president. And that's one of the things, is the president's, you know, it's up to them as far as who the members are of the committee, because we're representing our organizations.
Of course. Yeah, I guess what I was wondering, I was just kind of wondering out loud, is would there be some kind of a program saying, you know, this is how you do ogoshi, and we're expecting you to do ogoshi in this way? Was that ever the goal at some point, so that we have a standardized way of teaching judo techniques? Or is it more along the lines of a standardized way of running a dojo?
No, it's more of a standardized way of teaching the first few techniques of judo.
Okay.
And I guess more importantly, the order of teaching the techniques of judo.
What do you think, as a sensei, what do you think that order should be?
The order, it's Hizaguruma, Sasai. It could be Dashibarai. So what we're saying is, you know, for little kids, six-year-olds, teach them Dashibarai a little bit later, because when they're a white belt, just a few weeks on the mat, a foot sweep is more like a kick than a foot sweep.
Yeah.
And then we're going to Ouchigari, Osotogari. Rather than teach Ukigoshi to a little kid, teach them Ogoshi, because they won't know the difference. In an adult, you can probably show them the nuances. And then Seonage. So, you know, it's changing the order, start low, work high. And so actually, the Hizoguruma, we're starting doing it on your knees. And
oh, okay. And yeah, I've done that before.
So from Hizoguruma, then you're going standing. And then from Hizoguruma, move your foot from the knee to the ankle, and you have Sasai, you know. And so it's a progression of not as much, well, equally teaching Tori how to throw, but teaching them also how to be uke.
Of course.
That's what's important. You know, how do we teach them to be uke without scaring them off, right? And so if you're teaching them Seonage on day one, and you throw them with the Seonage on day one, they may not come back.
Right.
You know? And
right.
And I'll be honest, when I learned judo, the order was Osotogari, Ogoshi, Seonage.
That was what it was for me.
And even when I started teaching, that's what I taught. And I remember one time I was teaching two police officers, Osotogari, and one guy, his leg was planted on the mat, the uke, and Tori, when he did the reap, uke's knee went out, you know, and they never came back. I mean, Osotogari, it's a scary throw if you think about it.
Oh, it's devastating. It can be very
devastating. Fall. And you know, let's start a little bit lower. Let's do Hizaguruma from the knees, then do it standing. And really, you can control that fall. You're holding the sleeve as they come around, right? So you can guide them a little bit more than you can on Osotogari, because Osotogari, they're falling away from you, not around you.
Right. So right.
And you know, and the progression. Yeah, a lot of kids, they can't, and adults, they can't even do a forward roll. you know, that's one of the things in today's world is kids don't run outside and play and roll on the grass.
No.
We have so many kids that it's difficult for them to do a forward roll. So it's difficult to get kids to do a forward roll because they don't do that. And just trying to get them to do it on the mat is they're very, very scared. You know, they stiffen up. And so what we want is, you know, start teaching them their back falls, their side falls, then do the Hizogunuma Sasai. And then get them comfortable with the mat. You, in the same way, start teaching them mat work. You know, don't rush the throws. I mean, teaching them a pin and how to escape a pin, teaching them how to do a turnover, you know, it's very, very safe.
100%. Yeah, I agree. And it's still judo. It's still judo.
It's judo. You know? And you're getting them touching the mat, getting used to the mat, right? And so in addition to just teaching ukemi, you know, start showing them some newaza, some basic things. You know, just showing a kid to do kesa gatame and then escape it, you know, that's a big win. Right?
That's a big win. I agree.
For a little kid. And yeah, we don't have to rush doing ogoshi. We don't have to rush doing seonage. So get them used to the mat. Then get them doing rolling, just, you know, forward rolls. Not ukemi, just rolling. Get them used to that motion. And then change it to ukemi, doing zenpo kaiten, you know, and then teach them ogoshi and teach them seonage, you know. So I think we try to teach all the ukemi in one night or two nights, and then we try to get them throwing, you know, osotogari, ogoshi, seonage too fast. And, you know, it's scary. Falling is one of the, you know, innate fears that we have, right?
Absolutely.
And here we are, we're trying to get these kids to do something that, you know, and even for an adult, you know, you've seen an adult, we're trying to throw them and they're stiff as a board because they're afraid. And, you know, that's our fault. That's because we're not teaching correctly. We're rushing it and we just need to slow it down. And, you know, the guy that really influenced me on that is Shintaro Higashi. He had spoken at a USGF meeting and he talked about how he took over his father's dojo and he went from 30 members to 200 members. And what he did was, and I think it's an adult club. I don't think there's kids there, but what he did was at 6 months of newaza before they throw. You know, so they really get comfortable with the mat, they get conditioned and in shape, and then they can learn how to fall.
That's really interesting. I've advocated for a bigger newaza focus for adults coming in because, well, it's no secret that, you know, when we look at Brazilian jiu-jitsu, they seem to have found a really, for a variety of reasons, they seem to have found a pretty good way, a great way to keep people engaged in doing what is, I don't mean this disparagingly, but you go to a beginner jiu-jitsu class, it's basically the same exact stuff that you would learn at a beginner judo class. A lot of the more advanced stuff in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, you typically would not see in a judo club, but the basic stuff, it's the same, and yet this basic stuff is drawing a demographic that I think judo loses out on, and I think starting from the ground up is a great way to go about it. I don't know about 6 months without throwing, but certainly a month or two, I don't think there's anything wrong with that.
Yeah, and you know, it's I always say this. I say judo is so much better than jiu-jitsu. You know, judo came from jiu-jitsu and then Brazilian jiu-jitsu came from judo. And, you know, Brazilian jiu-jitsu has judo's newaza plus, but judo has throws. And how many times do you get a jiu-jitsu student who comes and, oh, I want to learn judo? And the reason they come is they want to learn throws. Well, you know, if we took them from a beginner and taught good techniques, Nelwaza techniques, and work our way to Tachiwaza techniques, you're going to take that person who may have done jujitsu. They don't need to go to jujitsu because they're doing judo and they're doing the grappling and they're throwing. But if we teach it properly, they'll stay, you know. And
yeah,
my other thing is, in the Nawaza side of judo, I think so many instructors are limited in their knowledge, right? They know, well, let's use Tachiwaza, for example. I think some instructors, they teach 10 throws, maybe teach 7 throws. Mm-hmm. And that's their comfort zone, you know. And judo is so much more interesting than that. There's so many different throws. And, you know, I tell my students, you know, we're going to expose you to these throws. You don't have to master them, but I want you to know them. So if someone does this on you, you know what they're doing to you. You know, you're going to master a handful of throws. You're going to have your favorite throw, but I want you to be familiar with other throws. And Nelwaza is the same thing. You know, Nelwaza is a lot of fun because you can do so many things. You know, you can, just in pinning, you can transition from pin to pin to pin. You know, you can transition from a pin to a choke to an arm lock. There's so many things we can do, but unfortunately, a lot of the instructors, they only know what they know, and they're not willing to go take a class to learn more judo. You know, it's there's so much to judo that we should be teaching people. And judo has so much to offer, and unfortunately, you know, this is what I know. This is what judo is. That's what my instructor taught me. And you know, even going back to Misty Momura, he used to go back to Japan just to go check out judo in Japan and right. come back and teach us. And, you know, even after big tournaments, it was like, okay, we're going to change our training. You know, we had to train harder, and he would change it, you know, to make us better.
Yeah.
And, you know, but he was a student of judo. And I remember one time he said, I'm going to go and go check out the level of judo in Japan. And he did, he went and, you know, and comes back and he has new ideas for us to do. And you know, it was an amazing thing. And I'm very passionate about, I truly believe judo is better than Brazilian jiu-jitsu. We just have to have the knowledge, you know. When we were in Colorado Springs, I took some things. And one of the things I took is, I have a list of all the techniques that I teach, Tachiwaza and Nelwaza. And I showed it to Chris Snyder, and he goes, hey, I have the same thing. And for his sport, he has all the things he teaches. And, you know, he was saying, all coaches should do this. We should have a list of what we know and what we teach, you know, and that way we can have it organized so we can teach it and then keep adding to that list.
And understand the gaps that you have.
Exactly. But I think so many of us were just in our comfort zone. And, you know, you know, I'm a higher ranking person, but I still don't, you know, every time Missy Momura showed something, I was like, oh yeah, I forgot that. Oh yeah. You know, we're just constantly learning, and we have to have that attitude. Unless we have that attitude of, let's keep improving ourselves as a judo instructor, as a judo coach, judo's not going to grow.
Yeah, I'm with you there. For myself, I have probably over the past 3 or 4 years really tried to expand my judo a bit, and I've come across techniques that I ended up being pretty good at that I didn't really think I had in me. And it's the process of pushing yourself to get out of your comfort zone, allow yourself, you know, even for myself, I mean, I've only been doing judo 14 years, compared to your 50, right? Your 50.
Yes.
Yeah. but I'm always looking to challenge myself and expand my repertoire, and, you know, whether that's focusing on throwing on my opposite side, whether that's just brand new techniques and not being afraid to to make mistakes and to get thrown in Rondori and things like that. I think there are people out there that lose that sense and feel that they just need to stick within their wheelhouse. And sure, it's fun. It's good to stick within your wheelhouse, but I think we should all be aspiring to really master what we do. And that can only happen if you're constantly learning and evolving. Now, I gotta, in light of this kind of conversation direction that we've gone, I'm curious to know, with the American Judo development model, where do you see kata fitting in all of this?
So if you look at the model, it actually has at stage three, consider kata as a teaching tool. And, you know, kata, if you've ever taken a kata class from Mrs. Shepherd, she always talks about how the techniques in kata apply to competition. And I've learned so much from her over the years taking classes from her that's improved my judo, my Randori judo, not just kata judo, because of the way she teaches. And so, you know, I think people need to look at kata as just, it's a teaching tool to improve all of our judo, not just for kata, not just for a promotion. We're putting on a virtual self-defense seminar in a couple of weeks. And, you know, a lot of what I learned was Mrs. Shepherd for that. And so, you know, kata is good for self-defense, and it's good for shiai, for competition.
Now, will there be, because I'll tell you for myself, it is very difficult to find anybody to teach kata on a regular basis. At least it is for me. I don't see any seminars. Do you envision that the idea and the attitudes toward kata changing? Because it has to change in order to be able to teach it. It's very, like I said, most clubs, they teach for sport, and there's nothing wrong with that, but it does make finding proper kata instruction very difficult. Maybe not out in California, but I'm telling you, I think for most places around the country, it's a challenge.
I think the number one thing is you're going to have to organize and bring someone to your area to teach a kata class. So here in the Central Valley, where there's two judo yudanshikais, San Joaquin Valley and Chuka Yudanshikai. In Chuka, they do an annual kata seminar with Mrs. Shepherd. And I think pretty much I've only missed one in I don't know how many years. It's just when she comes, we just, okay, it's on the calendar. We're going to the kata clinic. But, I know for USJF, there's funding for that. You can apply for funding to put a kata clinic in your area. I don't know about the other organizations.
Huh. Oh, okay. I didn't know that. That's really great. Now, with regards to coaching and development and stuff, what does the committees and their various people part of the American Judo development model, how do they feel about the adult demographic and trying to grow that? Because I mean, to me, when you're talking about getting more kids in the club, you're trying to convince mom, basically, in my opinion. But when it comes to adults, you gotta, the selling points have to be something different. Is there any long-term goals in trying to increase that demographic? Probably, I would say, if you need an age range, 18 to 35.
So in the live seminar, you know, the introduction of the live seminar is a PowerPoint presentation. And I'm modifying that PowerPoint presentation for parents and new judo students in the adult demographic. And so the idea behind this, and this was part of our coach committee actually, this is Pat Burris's idea, which, we, you know, when he said that, I was like, oh, that's brilliant, because we need to educate the parents and even adult judo students about the American Judo Development Model and why judo is so important. Because if we can educate the parents, hopefully then we got the kids, right? Because if the parents aren't sold, they're not going to bring the kids.
Right.
You know, oh, I want to watch this TV show. We're not going to judo tonight, you know. But if they're sold on judo, they'll get their child there. And so Pat Burris came up with the idea that, you know, hey, let's do an education program for parents. And so we're actually working on that version for the Dojo Sensei to do a short PowerPoint presentation to educate them. You know, and part of that is you can introduce your dojo, you can introduce yourself in this PowerPoint presentation. And so we haven't really worked out the details. I was talking to Keith Bryant yesterday about some of these ideas. And so, it, you know, again, this is evolving as we talk about it, as we develop it. But it, I think it's so important. I think when Pat said that, it was like a light bulb went on. That's brilliant. We got to educate the parents. And then maybe they'll become judo students. You know, in my club, that's one of the things is we have some parents who they're doing judo. And you know, I have an adult beginner judo program. And my goal is to take these adults through. So we do a lot of drills. We don't do a lot of free exercise, but we do a lot of drills, tachiwaza and nawaza. So they're being exposed to these techniques, and you know, their uchikomi is pretty good. And when we throw, a lot of time it's on a crash pad, you know, so they don't. And I tell my adult beginners, you know, we have to go to work tomorrow.
So, yeah,
you know, that's something that's very, very important. But my ultimate goal is for them to become brown belts, maybe help with the little kids, over time become black belts.
Yeah.
You know, and I sort of envision it as the little league parent becoming a little league coach.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, you talked about, we don't have enough judo coaches. I think this is something we need to do, is we need to have these types of programs of, let's train the adults, but let's not hurt them.
Yeah. Right.
And, so, like I said, in my program, it's a lot of drills. I teach them a lot of techniques, and you know, we do a lot of review. And then, you know, they do get promoted over time. And you know, some of my parents, they're competing in tournaments, and you know, they may not win, but they're having fun.
Yeah, it's a great experience to get out there and compete. Mm-hmm. It'd be to me, you know, when you're talking about your recreational judo, just stepping on the mat, you've already won, regardless of the outcome. That's kind of how I feel.
Absolutely, you know, and then it is, you know, the support from the other parents and from their kids when they're out there, and you know, you're not a loser, you're a winner, no matter
what. Yeah, agreed. Oh, will there be education on how to run a successful judo program? And this question is going more beyond on the mat coaching. This is more along the lines of dojo management and you know, I've heard some judo instructors, as a matter of fact, I think it was Pat Burris, talk about getting grant money to help run your club and things along those lines. Will there be that kind of information and education out there for coaches?
Yeah, so that's part of this, what the Foundational Task Force is working on now, is creating the next task force of the business and marketing task force. And that's what I think they're purposes is doing things like that. And I've spoken to Pat Burris and talked to him, and you know, he's a fountain of information on getting grants for judo programs. And you know, He has a student in Salt Lake City, Utah, who, when I was at a family reunion there, he was a fountain of information on grants also. It was, you know, so there is money out there. And I think we maybe that's something, hopefully, that this next task force will help educate people about. Well, you know, my biggest thing is I want to get across to people that, you know, as judo instructors, we all need to continue studying. I mean, how many judo instructors have read a non-judo coaching book? You know, and how many judo instructors have read a judo coaching book? You know, again, as like I said earlier, you know, a lot of instructors just feel like, well, I learned judo from my sensei and he's the judo god and I know it all. You know, and that's very unfortunate. I really, really think we all need to keep learning, and even, you know, coaching from outside of judo, you know, read some of the famous basketball coach books or baseball coach books, and, you know, learn about coaching people, not just judo.
That's a great point. I agree. Now, I do want to bring up one more thing. Throughout our conversation, you've talked up quite a bit the USJF and talking about programs that I wasn't aware of. Could you take a moment to maybe talk a little bit about the USJF and maybe some of the things that the USJF does differently than some of the other organizations? Because, like I said, I didn't know. I didn't know a lot of this.
I feel sort of.
I know it's hard to. It's, I know it's hard to, like, you know. There could be.
I'm supposed to be representing all of us. Let me. You know, maybe you can. Let me answer the question, and you can decide if you can what you want to do with it.
Okay.
And if everyone gets mad at me, if they get mad at me, they get mad at me.
Well, it's just a question. You know, if the USJF does things that are different, I think my listeners certainly, there's a lot. I got a lot. They would like to know that because a lot of times, and this is all stuff I'm going to cut. You know, a lot of times, you know, people ask, you know, which judo organization should I join? And it's like, well, I think the three organizations, I mean, there's more than three, but the three J organizations, they all service their memberships differently. And quite frankly, I know the least about the USJF, even though it's older than the USJA and USA Judo. I do know the least about it. So that's kind of why I was curious about, you know, things that maybe things that I don't know, but certainly other people may not know.
You know, so USJF is based on the Udon Shikai system, and the Udon Shikai system is a group of judo clubs, a group of black belts in an area. And you know, it used to be geographic, and you know, it's no longer geographic, but you belong to a membership of a group that works together. And so the idea is that things go from the national office to the Udon Shikais, to the clubs, to the individual members. And and they've always talked about, you know, in today's day and age, we need to go from the national office to the individual members. And one of the things USDF, I think they're trying to get going is a newsletter that will come out, you know, every 2 weeks or every month. I'm not sure how often. A couple of them have come out from Mark Maranaka. And, you know, the biggest thing is it's communication. And we have to, no matter what organization, we need to let people know, like what you're asking. You said you don't know much about USJF. And USJF has, you know, the coaching program, which obviously we talked about. They have a teacher's program. And the teacher's program focuses on having lesson plans, having you know, long-term plans for your dojo. which really we should have. We should be organized and have plans to teach to be more efficient rather than just teaching off the top of our head. And you know, there's a book out there that talks about rotating curriculum. I don't know if you've seen that.
I have not.
He's an author who writes a lot of business, martial arts business books. And the rotating curriculum is sort of an example of the USGF teacher program in that you have a set plan curriculum that rotates. And I sort of try to use that for Fresno Judo where, and you know, for the beginners, we have a set program that we use for beginners. And for the advanced, we rotate through different techniques during the year, Tachiwaza and Nenwaza. But the teacher program, you actually teach a lesson in front of your peers and you're critiqued by the instructors of the program. And you know, it does things like where you're positioning yourself or positioning, if you have people demonstrating, you know, do the demonstration in different angles and, you know, little tips like that, that make a big difference. And so USGF has that. And like I was telling you, the kata and the teacher's program and the kata program, I'm pretty sure if you apply, there's some money from those committees to pay for clinicians to come and put a teacher clinic on or put a kata clinic on. And you know, that's one of the things that USGF, you know, I always hear people say, well, USGF doesn't do anything for the membership. And you know, part of it is, well, you guys gotta ask. Right. USGF isn't just gonna say, hey, you want some money?
Yeah, you right.
You gotta say, hey, we wanna put a clinic on. Can we apply for a grant to put the clinic on? And you know, you work with the committee chairs, Mrs. Shepherd, or I think it's still Mrs. Shepherd. It might have changed, but Mitch Palacio is the teacher's chair. There's a self-defense committee in USGF, and same thing. If you want to put a self-defense clinic on to certify self-defense instructors, there's funding for that. And you know, it's just a matter of putting your application in and asking for the funding. There's scholarship money that USGF has for students. There's opportunities to go to Korea or Japan for a couple of different tournament and programs. And there's funding for that also. So it's sort of a, you got to ask, you have to apply.
Again, that's fascinating to me because I didn't know. I am not a member of the USJF, and if I were to become a member, it's not like I would be asking for bunches of money. But it's good to know that that's out there for students and coaches that they, if they need some kind of assistance, that that the USJF does provide that. That I had no idea.
You know, one of the key points of that we're trying to make also in the American Judo Development Model is that the more members we have, regardless of what organization, the more members we have, the more money we're going to have. And, you know, the way we look at it is the more money we have, the more we have to develop judo. And, you know, for USJ, JF, it's clinics and local tournaments. And for USA Judo, if they had more members, they would be funding their athletes more. But, you know, if you don't have the money, you can't do it.
Right,
but
of course.
If we can grow judo, you know, it's we have to change what we're doing because what we're doing now isn't working. And if we can become better instructors, have better programs, you know, there are so many kids out there who baseball is not for them, basketball is not for them, you know, but judo can be. Because, you know, a lot of these sports, it's like, you know, they can't hit the baseball or they can't shoot the basket and they get discouraged and they don't get to play on the team, you know. But in judo, everybody gets to play, right?
Agreed. Yeah. Yeah. I think judo, I love judo. I think it's great for kids. I think it's great for adults. It certainly helped me mature as a man. And I'm talking about somebody who started in their early 30s, and judo was really critical in my own personal growth and development as a made me a better man. I absolutely stand by that, which is why I'm always, you know, when I talk about judo as an adult and beginners and adult beginners and things like that, it's because I know personally there's a lot of people out there that could really benefit in the same way that I certainly did. And I've played other sports. Like, I love basketball. Basketball never gave me any of that. You know, skiing never gave me any of that. And other sports that I've played never have given me what judo has given me in my life. And that's big reason why I do the podcast, to share that enthusiasm with as many people that's willing to listen. And but I agree with you with the kids and the adults and anybody that steps onto the tatami. I think it's a life-changing activity.
Absolutely, it is. You know, yeah. I have friends, lifetime friends from judo. I have friends, you know, around the country. I have friends in Japan, all from judo. You know, it's just amazing.
So that's going to do it for my interview with Dr. Larry Tsutsui. I'm very grateful for his time, for him coming on, talking with me many months ago now. But Larry, I'm sure you're listening to this. I appreciate your time once again. And he's doing a lot of great things out with Fresno Judo. He's kept me posted with different ways that he's been trying to run his classes in the midst of this pandemic, especially with so many restrictions California has compared to Florida. Now, speaking of Florida, I think I can let this out of the bag now. I know I've teased this, certainly the last episode that I had and the episode before that. But in case you haven't figured out, my next guest is going to be Dr. Roddy Ferguson. And just like with my interview with Larry, this interview was recorded back in December. And I think you all are going to really enjoy it. I know people, at the very least in the United States and certainly around the world, are very familiar with who Dr. Roddy Ferguson is. He's been around the judo scene for a very long time. He competed in the Olympics in 2004. He's a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt. He's currently a Rokudan in judo. And he runs Tampa, Florida Judo out in Oldsmar, Florida. So it was a very, very fun conversation. I really can't wait to release it, but you're going to have to wait. You're going to have to wait about 2 weeks because I'm going on vacation in about 2 days. I'm finally crossing off an item on my bucket list. I'm going to Vail, Colorado. I've always wanted to ski Vail, and all the years that I've been going to Breckenridge, I really had no idea Vail was kind of right down the road. I would have gone to Vail instead. I've been wanting to go to Vail my whole life. So yeah, I'm finally going, and I'm very excited about that. I'll be masking it up inside the airport and the airplane and in the rental car and really everywhere. So it won't be the first vacation that I've taken since this pandemic started. And I believe that that there'll be social distancing on the airplane, I guess. I don't know. But I'm going. So anyway, that's going to do it for this episode of the podcast. I am going to have an after party shortly. But for now, we're done for the judo section. So with that, I hope you all have a great day. I hope you all have a great rest of the week. Train hard. Stay safe out there. And until next time, I'm out. Oppan Gangnam Style. Gangnam Style. Oppan Gangnam Style. The after party starts in 15 minutes. All right, so the after party. Well, first things first, I wanted to announce to my listeners, not that it really impacts, well, it impacts none of you except for the ones that are local to where I live. One of the big reasons why there's been such a break over the past 2 months for me to not put out new episodes is because I've been house hunting, and I finally found the house, or my family and I found the house, and we are going to be moving out of the Tampa Bay area. Now, I could sit here and bore you with all the details as to why we decided to do this, but really the bottom line is that at the end of the day, moving out of Tampa Bay is what's best for me and my family. Now, we're not leaving the state of Florida. We're just going to be moving up to the Panhandle, but it's still about a 5-hour drive away. I've looked around where I'm going to be living, and it turns out the closest place for me to do judo or Brazilian jiu-jitsu is going to be in Dothan, Alabama. So that'll all give you an idea of, generally speaking, where I'll be living in Florida. So I must say that my time in Tampa Bay over the past 20 years have been really nothing short of amazing. I love Tampa Bay. I'll always have ties to Tampa Bay, in particular because I have a lot of extended family and certainly many friends here, training partners, you know, friends outside of judo. I love this area. But like I said, I just felt like, or really my wife and I felt that it was, maybe we should explore our options and get the kind of house that we want to have, with the kind of property, with the kind of layout and everything. And basically the type of home that we bought is not a place that can be had around here for cheap. So I'm really excited about it. We're going to be moving mid-March. I will have the Dr. Roddy Ferguson interview released before I move, but you guys should know that once that's released, that it's going to be at the end of February, around that time, I'm probably not going to have another episode for another month unless there is something breaking that happens, and I'll always make time to do an episode for something that's serious. So there you go. That's the biggest reason why you haven't heard from me in a couple of months. Just the whole process of house hunting, getting documents together. We had to drive all the way up there just to look for homes, and we spent an entire weekend. And then there's been other things going on in my life at a more personal nature that I won't bore you with here. But this is really exciting times for me and my family, and I'm really looking forward to it. Now, on the show front, because I always love talking about shows here, I got to say that there's been 3 shows that I've watched over the past year, and they all kind of came around at around the same time, or they were on TV around the same time anyway. Recently I finished Parks and Recreation, and I finished The Office, you know, probably about a year ago now, and I'm watching this show called Community on Netflix. These shows were really brilliant. I didn't watch any of them when they were on NBC at the time. And, you know, I've heard a lot of people talk up The Office, and The Office was definitely great. It's one of the greatest shows on television. But for me, I actually preferred Parks and Recreation. I thought it was a better show. And, you know, one of the biggest reasons why I like that show so much is because the entire town was a part of the show in some weird way and such. And they were minor characters that just made that show really special. So yeah, I've been catching up on a lot of shows that passed me by 10 years ago, and I'm really enjoying them. Now, another show that I've been watching lately, and I can't believe I'm going to say this, I have been watching Star Trek, the original series on Netflix as well. And now, growing up in the early to mid-80s, I was a fan of the movies, you know, the movies that starred, you know, Spock and Dr. McCoy and Captain Kirk. I love those movies, but I never really watched the show because back then I was into the Transformers, I was into He-Man, so I wouldn't like watch those shows as a kid. It just wasn't for me. But over the past, I'd say about 2 or 3 weeks, I've been watching Star Trek, the original series, and I got to tell you, if you can get past the 1960s hairstyles and the 1960s special effects, this show is really tremendous. And I can't think of another television show that I've watched that really speaks to the human condition in the way that Star Trek does, at least the original series. I've not watched Next Gen. I've not watched any of the other Star Treks.
I mean, Star Trek shows. But I've really developed a great appreciation for what Gene Roddenberry did with Star Trek in the 60s and a lot of the themes that those shows were about. Now, on the more up-to-date front, there's this limited series on Showtime called Your Honor. That's a tremendous show. If you guys haven't watched that, that show is brilliant. It's starring Bryan Cranston, and while he's not revisiting his role as Heisenberg, but he's definitely taking elements of that role and fusing them into this role that he's portraying as a judge in New Orleans. And it's really excellent and riveting TV. At least it is for me. I don't know how you all feel about that, but it's a tremendous show. The series finale is going to be next Sunday, I believe. So if you've got nothing to watch and you haven't watched Your Honor, I would suggest you catch up on it, because I think I don't even know how they're going to end this show, but it's been amazing. Now, another show that I've watched over the past 2 weeks, which was really horrible, is a show called The Castle, and I think that was on Amazon or Hulu. I can't remember which one, but that show sucked. I really was optimistic about it because the show takes place in the same setting except 50 years in the future of what happened with the Shawshank Redemption. So it takes place in the same town and it involves the same jail. And they drop little nuggets every once in a while to the Shawshank Redemption movie, but it was very disappointing. I don't really even quite understand what I watched, but it was a tremendous disappointment. And I suggest that if you guys are looking at that and curious about it, give it a hard pass, because by the time episode 6 rolled around, I was thinking to myself, what the hell am I watching? But then I figured I was already pot committed, and I just figured I'd burn right through it and put it out of its misery. So I think that's all on the TV show front. I did see that new Wonder Woman movie. I thought it was horrible. It was terrible. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend to be woke and talk about the virtues of having a strong female character on screen and stuff. Wonder Woman, the first movie, was fantastic. I loved it. But this movie, it just fell apart. It portrayed the 80s in kind of a way that I don't really quite remember. I mean, I don't know. The whole thing, Pedro Pascal, you know, really worked hard with that character. Which, by the way, speaking of Pedro Pascal, two other shows that I got to talk about. The Mandalorian was a masterpiece. And I think I already discussed this in my last episode, but in case I didn't, it's the best thing the Star Wars universe has ever put out. Especially episodes 7 and 8 of The Mandalorian. They were just phenomenal. And the new show that they got out, WandaVision, I really love it. I'm digging it. And I guess what I really like about it is that they've gone through either the sequence of shows going through the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and such. And what I find humorous is that when I was a kid watching the Disney Channel, I used to watch those shows from the 50s and 60s and 70s because that's what Disney would play. They would play like Leave It to Beaver and I think like My Three Sons and other shows. And I used to watch that because, you know, back in 1983, I was just so fascinated with cable. It was back then for me, it was either the Disney Channel or MTV, back when MTV was actually awesome. So let's see. Do I get anything else? I don't think so. You all take care. Talk to you soon.